Hello and what is shaking, everybody? Welcome to a new episode of the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and we've got another dramatic news-filled episode for you today. As always, we're going to come at you live with a bunch of very incredible headlines from the last week or so from the wine industry to bring you into our world and just how crazy it is continuing to get. Before we get into that, thank you all so much for continuing to download, listen, and subscribe to the show here. Thank you all so much. I know a few of you are asking, hey, where the hell is our Q&A episode that was supposed to come out last week? And I'm working on it. I recorded it in my hotel room in St. Louis last Monday while I was on the road. For some reason, between transferring it to my laptop, getting it edited, and trying to upload it, the file got corrupted. I couldn't get it transferred back to my computer for some reason. I have no idea. I'm typically pretty tech savvy, but I have to re-record it. So this week, we're going to release this, if you're listening to this, on May the 7th. And we're going to get that Q&A episode out to you by this weekend. I do have to spend some time to re-record it, get it re-edited, and all that stuff. Stupid technology fighting back against me, which is annoying. But we will get to your questions. I promise. We got them coming down the pipeline. But I wanted to get this episode out on time, as it should be scheduled, because the headlines this last week, my goodness gracious. It is, let's just read them off, shall we? Let's just read them off real quick. In order, we're going to cover these. It looked like Napa's most promising wine empire. What happened? Oh, tough one there. Duckhorn to wind down, canvas back, migration, Paradox, and Postmark brands on top of other things. We'll get into that. And Bordeaux 2024, Cheval Blanc cuts price by nearly 30%. Ooh, Lynch Baj has done the same thing. There are plenty of people offering discounts right now in Bordeaux during un premier. Ex-Negociant, actually, maybe. Maybe it's not un premier. But anyway, it's things are being discounted heavily when you wouldn't expect them to be. Let's dive into it, shall we? I'm just going to get right into it. You know you can follow me on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines, Instagram, YouTube, Book of Face, social network formerly known as Twitter. Head to our website, mtgawines.com, sign up for our mailing list, answer your questions for the Q&A on the email form on the homepage. Just scroll down all the ways, you'll find it. Again, that's mtgawines.com. I'm going to try and condense down like the salesy stuff a little bit because I hate doing it. You probably hate listening to it. You probably hit the 30-second skip on it anyway. So we're just going to get into the action. The Promising Wine Empire. This was written by Esther Mobley and Jess Lander in the San Francisco Chronicle, by the way. If you want to read any of these articles, head to the description of the video. They might be behind a paywall. You could probably do it in read only. You might be able to find this somewhere else. The Reddit threads on all this stuff is fantastic read. But to give you a little background, this is 7 or so years after a ag tycoon by the name of Galen Lawrence Jr., purchased Heights Cellars back in 2018. And some of you, you know, in recent history, if you're really dialed into wine, have heard a lot of Lawrence family and their wine estate and kind of the empire they've been building here in the wine industry over the last 7 years, starting with Heights. You also looked at them acquiring Burgess, Stony Hill, the old Luna property. They started Brendel Cellars, I think that's how you pronounce that, as well as Ink Grade. This is just, they came in hot and heavy, made a huge splash, hired on Master Somm Carlton McCoy to lead the charge and really start kind of overhauling and we'll say updating all of these properties that I just mentioned. It has been a whirlwind and they have been getting after it. And this article basically goes on to state that it's quickly been, you know, ground to a halt, almost, as it seems. You know, as McCoy stated back in 2022, we are rebuilding old brands that haven't always been seen as luxury estates, so really trying to elevate some of these brands. And then you also have him saying later that you have to have a sustainable company. To do that, we couldn't keep all the overhead. So there's been a lot of downsizing. There's been some layoffs, I'm assuming, all kinds of other things. You know, the article states that Lawrence Wine Estate has, quote, also simply fallen prey to the punishing effects of today's plunging wine market and is not the only large company making major changes, which is 100% true. They cite Vintage Wine Estates declaring bankruptcy last year. And as we talked about previously, Constellation Brands divesting from a lot of its low-end wineries and Jackson family confirming layoffs. There's just all kinds of stuff to dive into here. Now, I've had the pleasure of actually going back up to Stony Hill Vineyards, which is one of their holdings and something that they spent a lot of time and money renovating and kind of dialing back in. I have not been to Heights, although I've tried some of the newer wines. I haven't had anything from their Inc. Grade holdings. Brendel, I have tried, and because Brittany ended up going to their tasting room down in Napa, that has since closed. All kinds of stuff to unpack here. Now, there is kind of within the industry, and I'll give you guys a little of the inside track here. You know, Carlton McCoy, who is the master som, kind of leading this charge in this company right now, has mixed reviews in the Valley. I've been lucky enough to, you know, be in his, you know, presence, I suppose. That's a weird way of saying it, but around him and had good interactions with him. I know there are plenty of colleagues of mine that have not had that. There have been plenty of others that said, yeah, he's, you know, what you would expect from master som trying to lead this big operation. Like, it's crazy. So, you know, there's a lot to be said, I suppose, there and around there. I'm going to try and avoid that because regardless of what you think of the man and what's going on, this is more of a conversation about where the wine industry is and perhaps, you know, where this business is. It seems, for me, kind of looking through the tea leaves here, that this is very akin to vintage wine estates last year, kind of getting out over their skis, buying a lot of property, making a lot of investments, capital improvements, and frankly, just a slowing wine market that is grinding things to a halt. It seems to be they seem to be a little bit of a victim of that. I believe it's stated, in the article there somewhere that, they charge for, I think, one of the Heights tasting experiences, and this is one of their cheaper experiences, $125 a person, and that does not break even for them, which I think is a huge problem. We'll get into that in a second. Because, we've talked about, you can go back and, listen to our tasting fee episode. I know no one likes paying tasting fees, but there's a reason why they exist. You also have to keep in mind, and I'll tell you from my experience up at Stony Hill, the wines, in essence, doubled in price since the acquisition and have become far more expensive. I spent way too much money on a six-pack of wine because they were Mike Collini's wines. For those of you that don't know, Mike Collini made the wines up at Stony Hill for 40 years until he was kind of let go, pushed out, maybe. We don't know, kind of. And that was during kind of the Long Meadow Ranch era. And then when that was purchased, then Lawrence family purchased Stony Hill from the Long Meadow Ranch family farmstead. Some of you know that restaurant in the Valley as well. So hop, skip, and jump for that brand. And I have to say, first impression of going up there and seeing the place and what they had done with the place, I was like, God damn, they really put in a lot of money into this. They've renovated it a lot. The experience was, albeit we were a bunch of industry people doing this, so the experience was a little different for us. The host was trying really hard to garner our attention. And frankly, we're like, we've been drinking these wines for 30 years. So spare us the story. We already know it. We just want to come up here, get to know you, get to know the place and kind of what's changing or how things are going up here under kind of this new leadership. It was a little sterile, fine tasting experience, but a little bit sterile. The wines were fine. There was nothing particularly you never rubbed the wrong way. It was a good time. We had a good time up on the hill. And it's a beautiful spot. The wines were delicious, so on, so forth and such as, I've had the pleasure of trying some of the new Heights wines, as I mentioned, haven't been to the site, based on some of the photos and the article and others that I've seen, man, the place looks spectacular. It appears as though they kind of went the fine dining route when it came to their tasting experience, trying to live up to almost maybe you're probably not going to get a Michelin star, but have that level of service, very dialed in, very pristine kind of lines and stuff of that nature. And I think it begs the question for me, and kind of going back to that $125 experience that doesn't pay the bills, is so what are you expecting? What were the goals here? And I think the quote that, is that Carlton had in this article, we're trying to, in essence, I'm paraphrasing here, that we're trying to revitalize brands that haven't been seen as luxury brands. So they're really trying to elevate these things. I think my only real bone to pick here, if I was going to pick one, is that's not necessarily what Stony Hill and Heights have ever been known for, or Burgess for that matter. They obviously have a huge amount of history. They obviously have a great pedigree here in the Valley, but luxury and kind of dialing in, you know, what is almost this like Michelin star restaurant experience isn't what those brands were all about. Yes, you probably, for like the case of Heights, you probably needed to start charging for tastings and not just giving away for free, because that is a huge cost center for wines, as we've talked about on the show quite a bit. You know, you probably needed to take some price increases on the wines, depending on, you know, what your overhead and expenses are. Again, I don't have access to their books. I don't know, but maybe price increases were necessary. Did they need to double or triple the price of some wines? You know, I'm being a little, you know, facetious. I said that dumb. Being a little dramatic there, but, you know, they are much more expensive, especially for some of the library wines that are available. Those are way more expensive than what they typically would be under these brands and their prior regimes. You know, so maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a combination of a couple things. One, slowing wine economy. Two, you know, changing a lot too fast and, you know, not maybe not necessarily alienating their current consumer base or previous consumer base, but trying to, you know, it's kind of slowed down their buy-in because things just happen so quickly. I don't know. It seems as though this definitely, you know, kind of smells of, you know, vintage wine estates and doing a lot really, really quickly and figuring like, hey, we're going to do all this high-end luxury stuff and really put a lot of money and capital investment into this, only for things to really slow down at a precipitous rate and kind of end up banging your head against the wall multiple times. So, you know, I don't think that there's anyone, regardless of, as I mentioned, your opinion of Carlton, you know, in the industry, or Lawrence family as a whole and how they've kind of operated and trying to, you know, as they state, kind of revitalizing these brands as luxury brands. Whatever you think of that, I don't think anyone's sitting back here hoping that they fail, you know. Heights, you know, I grew up with some of their kids. Like, that's a label that I've been drinking since I was very young, right? I'm very familiar with those wines and have been historically. Stony Hill is the same thing. Shoot, the HBIC herself played bocce with Mike Collini the entire time that she was been on this bocce league before he passed away a few years ago. So, like, there are some really amazing heartstrings attached to these places. And I think, for me, you know, it's always a little bit of disheartening when you see kind of a legacy brand sell. You know, I think back to, you know, when Mondavi sold to Constellation back in the early 2000s. I was in high school at the time. You're like, shit, no one's, you know, impervious to this kind of thing. So now, having seen that, having been a part of a company like Boisse Family Estates and working there for 6 years and seeing what they did with Raymond, what they're, you know, doing with Buena Vista and Deloche before both of those, of trying to kind of maintain these legacy brands, it's a tall order. You can't just do it. You still have to, you know, obviously these brands that have maybe fallen on hard times need to be revitalized. They need some work. You know, you're going to have to get under the hood and really check in on things and see what's going to work. You know, it's not easy. It's really, really difficult, especially when you have brands that are historically, you know, maybe focus on the wholesale side of things right now. We've talked about like retail and restaurant sales for wine have been dropping every year for the last 4 years. So like the wine industry and the wholesale game is not in like a full-blown recession. It's like not, I wouldn't say a meltdown either, but it's not good out there right now. And I'm not really sure, you know, in the last 7 years, you know, maybe there was some writing on the wall, maybe there was some smoke, but no one said, hey, there's a fire. You know, it's maybe that's a poor analogy for California and Napa right now, but hey, that's all I got. I don't know. It's, you know, I think that when it comes down to stuff like this, I mean, it sounds like maybe they're trying to course correct and figure things out. I think one of my biggest problems, and again, if there was a bone to pick here, you know, the thing about kind of the luxury experience kind of things, like no harm, no foul. In this day and age, consumers and folks that visit the Valley, this may include some of you, maybe it doesn't, but they come here for the experience and the connection and all this other stuff. So focusing on that's a good thing. But I think my question kind of lies in, like, do you think that everyone wants, like, a Michelin-style or, like, really pristine tasting experience at a winery? You know, where you're seated at a table, it's white linen kind of, you know, very, like, you know, dialed in, great maybe experience. Or do you want people to, like, sit in the cellar with you at a table that might be, yeah, this is where we do blending, and it's a little messy, and there's barrels laying everywhere, and we're waxing bottles, so there's a power cord running down the hallway for someone getting work done. Like, is it, does it really kind of provide this, like, the real experience that people want? And I think that that's kind of the key problem with some brands right now. If I were to guess, and this isn't just, you know, me trying to rag on Lawrence Family here, but, you know, there's not really anything particularly authentic about that when it comes to how those brands have operated in the past. Now, yes, do we want to elevate them to be more luxury brands? Sure. But how can you do that in the confines of what that brand has historically been known for and build on that rather than do like a full reset? That seems to be the issue here. You know, the downturn in the market and lack of visitation and all this other stuff, you know, the lack of permitting transparency and the issues with Napa County, obviously that's a whole can of worms that we talked about a couple episodes ago. Please go back and listen to that if you haven't. It's absolutely fucking bonkers. There's so many, there's just like this confluence of factors. And, you know, as we all sit here and kind of shake our crystal eight ball and figure out, you know, which way is up and where is this industry going right now in a very tumultuous time, you know, we keep seeing these shots across the bow of big companies and these quote like empires that are having rough goes, which brings us to, frankly, the next article, which is Duckhorn, you know, to wind down Canvasback, Migration, Paradox, and Postmark brands. They're closing tasting rooms. They're going to be focusing more on kind of what are their core brands, which are Duckhorn, of course, Kosta Browne. Yes, Duckhorn does own Kosta Browne, for those that don't know. Decoy and Sonoma-Cutrer, although they're closing the Sonoma-Cutrer tasting room. They are going to continue with Goldeneye, Calera, and their Green Wing brands. Those latter two I've actually never heard of, but here we are. You saw the same thing that we talked about, you know, with the Silver Oak family, the Duncan family, and wrapping up a lot of what they were doing with Toomey. You're seeing a lot of kind of these secondary, tertiary, how do you say that by four or five? Like these extra brands that have fallen on hard times, you know, because they've been kind of more broad market brands. They've been probably producing them in X amount of volume, and now there's just not enough demand, and there hasn't been for a couple of years now. So you see this kind of winding down and this continuing a contraction, you know, across, you know, the industry. And when you see, bringing us to our third article that I mentioned, when you see things like Cheval Blanc being discounted 30%, you see, you know, Grand Cruz or, you know, First Growth being discounted heavily, you're like, oh shit, like it's really hitting everybody really hard. Like these wines just are not moving at the rate at which people expected. And the slowdown has been happening for some time. It seems to me, and again, I don't want to hate on anybody here, but it seems to me that people were just riding the high of the last 14 years and the blinders were on and they continued to expect unmitigated growth like we've seen in the wine industry. Since the Great Recession, the wine industry, the alcohol industry maybe in general, but certainly the wine industry has exploded. The amount of investment, the amount of new brands, the amount of people getting into it, the expansion in terms of production and scale of everything has just gone crazy. And you saw it, and this was, quite frankly, we saw a little shakeup, and I want to say 2016-17, because that's when myself, along with some friends, we started our kind of traveling roadshow of wineries. We saw like a little slowdown happening. And we're like, we need to get out there and we need to get in front of people. That's how, for those of you that have attended some of those events and been a part of these collective tastings that we host around the country, that's how that started. It was, hey, we need to find the demand for our wines because it's, you know, we're having a little bit of a tough go. Tourism's down. Sales aren't where they want them to be. We need to be creative. Let's get out there. And so we've continued that, and many other wineries and companies have partnered together to copy and paste, you know, our program and go from there, which is good on them. Like, get out there, go sling some juice. And then 2020, and this is, you know, unique to Napa, and then 2020 happens, COVID, the whole nine, happy hour continues to get earlier and earlier and earlier. We also have, you know, fires roll through our area. And going into 2021, we saw this boom, the busiest and the biggest year that Napa had arguably ever had. People coming out in droves once they could travel again and were comfortable traveling again after being locked up for almost a calendar year, right? You saw people buying wine hand over fist because we're hanging at home all the time. We're not going out to eat. We got to have wine at home so we can drink it here. And the sales were just flying out the door. And then you saw in the latter half of 2022, it was like the faucet turned off. And I shit you not, we talked about this in the industry. A lot of friends and colleagues, we talked about this, that come May and into June of 2022, business slowed down immensely. You had people starting to travel abroad again. You had folks all stocked up on wine and having to go back to the office. They weren't drinking, you know, white wine with lunch, you know, at their home anymore. Like everything started to shift again. And in 2023, we happen to have one of the bigger vintages we've had recently, a very hot, cool, but high quality year. You had people really hammer production growth in 21 and 22 post fires to try and, you know, mitigate some of the losses they had from that 2020 vintage and stockpile kind of, you know, wine so they could, you know, go gangbusters. The only issue with that, of course, is that, you know, people aren't necessarily going to buy more wine because you didn't make a 2020. They're going to buy the same amount of wine. And that's it. Like, I think that was kind of like this red herring argument of like, oh, we didn't make any wine in 2020, so we got to make so much more to make up for it. It's like, yeah, that's not really how that works, because you only have X amount of demand. If you bolster your production, you're going to end up with a lot of wine sitting around, because your client, unless you have some magical, you know, list of people that are going to buy, you know, time and a half, you know, what they normally buy, or you've somehow opened up this new market that needs that wine, you know, good on you. But otherwise, you're just going to have a bunch of extra stock. And then starting, of course, in 2020 into 2021, you started to see the downturn of retail sales and restaurant sales around the country. So you saw all this bolstered production trying to make up for lost time in 2020. You saw people getting back to kind of a normal lifestyle of wine drinking, you know, with dinner and a couple times a week versus all of the time. I'm not proud of this, but Brittany and I were going through, I mean, during COVID, Brittany and I were going through like a case of wine a week, because we would open up a bottle of white wine sometime around mid-afternoon, early evening. And then when the evening came around, it's like, you know, let's cook dinner. Let's open up some red wine. It was a clean two bottles a day. And that doesn't count the cocktails we were having, right? So things changed. Things kind of got back to normal. And it appears to me, whether it's some of these big brands and companies we're talking about, or even some of us small guys, it appears that a lot of people weren't paying enough attention to that. It's not that they were being like totally ignorant, but it's when you see the bright, shiny thing of like growth and sales and exciting stuff happening, it's easy to get caught up in that. Shoot, I got caught up in that. When 2023 came around and we were making a lot more wine because of a bumper crop year and I was excited, it was like, oh, this is great. Despite the slowdown in the latter half of 2022, and things were pretty good in 23 for us actually from a sales perspective. So like, this is great. And then 2024 came around. And it's like, oh shit, like the rug is getting pulled out from underneath people now. Like if you were having a tough time the latter half of 22 that continued in 23 and it hit you really hard in 24, that's why you're seeing some brands really struggle, some big companies really struggle. Because I think, you know, using Vintage Wine Estate as an example, you're having folks that kind of just were riding this big wave, not realizing that there wasn't another one behind them to catch. You know, the tide's going out or whatever. I don't know. I'm from California. I'm not a big surfer. I've been surfing twice in my life, and I got up on a board maybe once out of those two times I've been surfing. So that's probably not a good analogy for me to use. But you're probably picking up what I'm putting down. Is that, and shoot, I had this with certain companies that I worked with kind of post Great Recession as well, where they were expecting double digit growth, and not just double digit growth, but like 20, 30% year after year after year. And I'm looking at these budgets and these numbers. I'm like, dude, there's just no fucking way. Like, this is not happening. This does not exist in the realm of the wine business, save a Dave Finney or a Meiomi, you know, a Prisoner kind of brand that just blows up. Right? Like, that happens so rarely. And I'm excited that you're excited about this and that there's great potential here, but let's temper some expectations. And I think looking back at the last 4 years, no one was tempering expectations. People saw unlimited growth for more than a decade. They saw people drinking wine hand over fist. You saw just an amazing wine economy just burning down the highway, right? And, oh, hey, Freddie, what's going on? And from there, I think people got wrapped up in it. And now we're starting to sit here and see, like, okay, like, we need to find a way forward. And there might be more people that end up way out over their skis and end up having to divest from certain things like Constellation brands. You might see more Duckhorns or Silver Oak saying, hey, there are these other brands that we have that we just are, they're just not operating the way that we need them to. They're not profitable. You know, you might see someone like Lawrence Family Estates look at all the investment and the money that they're spending to conduct certain experiences while also significantly raising the prices of their products and just not seeing enough consumer buy-in and be like, well, we got to change something here. You know, we can't necessarily become like a bargain brand. You don't want to do like the Hublin thing back in the day with like what they did to Inglenook. I mean, they turned it into a jug wine brand after it had been one of the most iconic labels in Napa for a stretch. So you don't want to do that and completely bastardize something and destroy it. You still want to maintain some sort of integrity and whatnot. All right, bye, Fred. Our cat just walked in and out, just came to say hello. So I don't know. You know, every company and business is going to have to find their own way forward, right? And I think, you know, based on what I saw and the, you know, folks that I talked to on the road, and this is the great state of Missouri where we're shout out to everybody in, you know, Columbia, Springfield, St. Louis, and Kansas City that we saw while we were on this trip. It was an amazing run. But let me kind of extol some of the things that, that's the wrong word to use, like I'm extolling the virtues of this, but maybe that's a good way to put it. Let me extol like the virtues of like being on the road and boots on the ground in a market for 9 days and talking to people about what's going on. Number one was the reaction to just Napa wine in general. I can tell you firsthand, at least in this state, and maybe it's a handful of others, but if Missouri thinks this, then I guarantee you there are other markets that think this, that retailers and restaurateurs are looking at Napa as, one, severely overpriced for the quality because it's just this juicy, jammy, oaky, knock your socks off wine, which, fair enough, there's a time and place for that. But the overall vibe around Napa was not good. Period. Full stop. It was not good. And I'm very lucky that I had great conversations with some of these folks and that they enjoyed our wines, but that's because we make very typically lower alcohol, more restrained, less oak wines. Like, that's just what we do. So as soon as they said that, I'm like, you're going to be stoked when you try this Merlot and this Cab because it is not what Napa has been for the last like 10 years. The overall opinion of Napa quality is that it's overblown right now and that there's better value to be found elsewhere, at least in this market. And I think you're seeing that ripple through, you know, places like Duckhorn, places like Lawrence, places like Silver Oak, and you know, others that have, you know, had to roll up certain brands, you know, make layoffs and really start consolidating things in a way because there are people that just aren't that into it, right? And, right, I mean, I'll be honest here, like, our wines aren't particularly affordable, but at least they're the style that people seem to be asking for or looking for right now. It's not this overblown, you know, crazy, you know, over-extracted thing. I don't know. But that was kind of the first point I took from being on the road last week, is that the vibe around Napa in general, especially when it comes to like the retail restaurant level, not good, period. And again, you know, Missouri, and this is no hate on Missouri, because, you know, there are just bigger cities elsewhere. You know, it might not be the biggest wine market in the country, but damn it, it's got a great food and beverage scene, and they know what the fuck they're talking about. They absolutely, in fact, I've had, in like recent history, over the last like 3-4 years or so, I've had two of the best wine dinners I've ever had, pairing-wise, with our wines in Springfield and in Columbia, Missouri. Like, just outrageous stuff that you would never expect. And I'm very excited to get back there and do more of these because it's just like they've got this great scene and they're looking for, you know, wines that are more restrained and more to kind of like what we do and kind of our style. It's really cool to see. Really, really cool to see. And folks are looking for great value. The brand name doesn't necessarily mean as much other than it's reliable. Yeah, I mean, you go out to a wine shop and you see Silver Oak on the shelf. You're like, oh, I know what I'm getting with that. That's how I was actually. One of my favorite wines anytime I was traveling around the country to just drink if I had it, you know, if I saw it by the glass, was Flora Springs and their Trilogy, their Red Blend. That for me was like bang for your buck, one of the best wines out there because it helped that we knew them. Like, it was someone that I knew personally and who had made the wine and had friends that have worked there. So there's a great personal connection. But on top of that, I knew it was fucking good juice and that I could rely on it to be really, really tasty, right? And not this overblown, over-manipulated, over-manufactured wine, right? Like, it was really, really good. Really, really good. So that was one side of it, was kind of like just the overall vibe when it came to, you know, the retail and restaurant side of things as it pertains to kind of the state of Missouri. Now, what was interesting is, you know, a lot of folks are kind of quoting this, a lot of this wine kind of downturn. Also on the direct to consumer side, you know, people are drinking less. Gen Z is not into wine at all. You know, everything from legalized cannabis is stealing airtime from wine to, you know, just people trying to be on health kicks or whatever. You know, we've talked a lot about the kind of prohibitionist movement, and that'll be a bigger part of the Q&A episode that we're going to release over the weekend. But that, you know, based on what other people are seeing, like by the numbers, that doesn't really seem to be the case. Like consumption, you know, outside of the retail and restaurant, like purchasing, like it seems as though people in general are drinking like roughly, like it's kind of, from what I've seen, I don't have like a, there's not been like a great study to back this up, but anecdotally folks are saying like, hey, it's like been basically within a margin of error. Sure, it's dropped off a little bit, but we're waiting for this younger generation to get into wine and to be able to afford, you know, higher quality wines that are more expensive, you know, not the seltzers, not, you know, cheap, you know, flavored shots of whatever. You know, you're looking for people to kind of grow up within, you know, what their consumption is, if they're going to consume at all, right? And I think that that's kind of now been proven, is that, you know, you do have certain younger generations, whether it's us millennials or Gen Z, that are, you know, genuinely curious about wine and curious about these experiences and, you know, things, and they want to be a part of it, but it's just going to take time to kind of bring them in. Which kind of brings me back to, you know, what we were talking about in terms of some of these like luxury experience and just the expense of, say, Napa, you know. Like our tasting fee is $75 a person. If you're a member of our wine club, we waive that. But, you know, that's on the low end. You know, a lot of tastings, you know, talking about like the Lawrence family tasting fee that goes up from $125. You see other places that it's easily $125, if not more. You know, that's a tall order. If you're traveling with a group of four people and you're out, you know, you're out $500 just to show up. And then you got to buy wine that's $125, $130, $150, $200 a bottle on top of that. You know, and hopefully maybe there's some work to be done in terms of like waiving a tasting fee or helping you out with shipping or whatever. You know, every winery is going to be different. But that's a tall order, you know, on top of just getting here and staying here and getting transportation and all that other stuff. So this is, you know, there's a lot to take in here. And this is why we said, you know, talking about these three articles in regards to Lawrence family and kind of the empire they were building, Duckhorn winding down some of their brands, and Bordeaux discounting heavily some of their, you know, first growths and, you know, Premier Cru's and things. It's kind of a crazy time. I'm trying to look and see if there's like anything else that I missed. So actually, I mean, here's a good example. You know, again, not to harp too much on Lawrence family, but you look at, you know, Stony Hill Chardonnay went from roughly $60 a bottle up to, you know, $125. You look at the Cabernet Sauvignon, went from $90 to $250. And McCoy is quoted as stating the wines are very deserving of the prices. And that he wanted to, quote, put them on a pedestal. You know, that's fine. You know. You do have other folks that have, you know, talked about this. You have a gentleman by the name of Bill Cadman, owner of the Tukulay Winery that bought Haynes Vineyard grapes for 47 years before Lawrence Wine Estate stopped selling them to him in 2022. You know, and allegedly they're releasing bottles of Chardonnay that are $250 a bottle. You know, there's like, does that make sense? And like in this economy, does this make sense? You know, and maybe it does. You know, maybe they're in that transition still. You know, where they've put a lot of this time and money into these brands, and you know, if you're going to reset your pricing and kind of what you're known for, I mean, that's like a 5 minimum year process, I think. You know, I'm no expert in business. I know enough to be dangerous. But I do know that if you're doing these large overhauls and trying to make these adjustments to what have been established brands, it's going to take a long time, right? It's, you know, the second you start operating a certain way and your customers know that and get used to that, if a drastic change is made between the type of experience you're offering, the price of the wines that you're offering, whether or not you personally think they're deserving of that, because they very well may be, there might be a way for you to say like, hey, these wines are objectively 2.5 times or more better than what we were doing previously. And we're spending that much more on these wines to make them that much better. That very well could be the case. I doubt it. You know why I doubt it? Because this goes back to what I say all the time, is that it's subjective. And if the people that have liked your wine historically, you know, have been willing to pay X, that doesn't mean that they're willing to pay Y when you quote unquote, you know, improve things. You know, it's a hard reset on your brand, your image, and you're going to have to find, especially when you start pricing wines like that, a whole new stratosphere of people. And that's fine. That's fine. It's doable. But if you're not paying attention to the market conditions, the downturn of where things are going, the lack of visitation to Napa, if you're losing money on the tasting experience and the fee you're charging, on top of not seeing nearly as many people as you want to see, whether that's because of Napa County or not, you've clearly not paid attention to the other external factors that are pressuring your business. Now, I'm not saying that's the case with Lawrence. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case with Silver Oak or Duckhorn or Cheval Blanc or any of these folks that are kind of going through, or Vintage Wine Estates, even though they went bankrupt. You know, I'm not saying that's their problem necessarily. But if you're going to sit out here and try and read through the tea leaves, those are the things that you're trying to take into consideration. And hopefully, I mean, there are very smart people that work at any one of these brands and for any one of these labels. You have to assume that someone was pointing to a dark cloud and being like, I'm pretty sure that's smoke. And unfortunately, there might have been someone, you know, higher up than them that said, well, it might be smoke, but it's not fire. We'll be fine. And here we are. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Wind Up Podcast. Again, if you want to check out these articles, please go show them some love. Those links are all in the description of the video here for you to check out. Interesting times, as always. I think we're gonna start. I like these little news updates thing, especially at least at the beginning of the month, so we can kind of like dive into like what's exciting, what's new, what's happening in the industry, kind of the major things that are coming down the pipeline. Because a lot of this stuff, there's like a couple of outlets where if you're like really in tune with the wine industry, that you'll see this. But for the most part, you'll never see this. Is not gonna make national news. You know, this is not that kind of stuff. But if you're really into wine, this is the kind of stuff that you should be aware of, in my opinion, especially if you're just curious about the state of Napa, the wine industry, and why things are easier or harder for you to find, or why certain wines have gone up incredibly in price without really knowing that maybe it's sold and things have changed and it's trying to be more of a luxury brand or whatever the case is, right? So hopefully you get a little bit more of that information here. Thank you all for tuning in. Again, follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines, YouTube, Instagram, the Book of Face, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. Head to our website, mtgawines.com. We're just getting through our spring release. So if you're on our mailing list, that's going to be in your email inbox here shortly. You can sign up for our mailing list on our site. There's also more information on our wine club, our wines, all that good stuff. If you need to submit a question for the Q&A, slide into our DMs or scroll down on our homepage and fill out that email form, submit your questions that way. Have an excellent rest of your day. Love you guys. Mean it. We'll see you next time on the Wind Up Podcast. Cheers.